The grid is aging fast and demand is rising even faster.
We need to reduce the amount of time that it takes to get to a plan in order to be able to make the investments to meet the demands that we have of the future.
We often speak a lot with the sort of U.S. first perspective, but this is a global problem.
Modeling is critical for us to continuously look at not just what do we need today, but what is this system of the future going to look like? We have to get trust into this process. Those are 30, 40, 50, 60 year investments.
How you plan for that possibility that something really crazy could happen, but also something really innovative could happen in the next couple of years.
We need to continue investing in the innovation, but at the same time, we have to be grounded in the practical reality of deliverability.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Power Perspectives. I'm Kinsey Grant Baker, and this one is going to be chock full, so let's just jump right in. I think it's time for a thinking reset. We have spilled a lot of ink here on this show and across the energy industry talking about a reality we all know to be true. The grid is aging fast and demand is rising even faster. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm of the mind that it's time we start focusing a little less on just identifying a problem we've already identified and a little more on talking about solutions. The big question I think we should be asking, where do we go from here? How do we accelerate practical tools, sophisticated modeling, and tech-forward processes in order to help the whole world build clean, reliable, affordable power systems, both faster and cheaper? And when I say the whole world, I mean it, and this guest knows it. It's time to get solutions-oriented in a wide-ranging conversations about modeling and how it can redefine energy innovation with today's powerhouse guest, Alice Yake, head of grid modeling at Breakthrough Energy, which you might know as the Bill Gates-founded team of scientists, engineers, and experts working to accelerate the development and deployment of clean energy technologies across our world. Alice, welcome to Power Perspectives. How are you today?
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm really looking forward to our conversation, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts.
Yeah, me too. I'm thrilled to have you here. We have a big conversation lined up, as I mentioned. But before we dig into any of that, I would love, if you don't mind, just telling me a little bit more about your career. You know, it's a fascinating one. You've got a unique perspective. So if you don't mind, can you tell me a little bit about kind of how you got where you are, the quick tour of your resume?
No, absolutely. I'm happy to share. And I think most people out there, other than those in very specific professions, would have to say there are always turns and things that you don't expect in your career. And I think that's something I can definitely say about mine. So I graduated from Texas A&M, whoop, to all you Aggies out there. And my degree was in management information systems. So I really focused on software development. I was a coder. And so I went into the oil and gas industry at a little known company called Enron. And then got laid off with, 3,000 of my closest friends when everything went south back in 2001. But there I learned some really foundational pieces of the puzzle, which is how do you show up in a highly intensive, very intelligent environment and deliver on things that people really weren't doing. And so from the coding perspective, I was programming broadband trading back then. They were the first of the kind taking it on. And so it was a really unique opportunity to build from there. After getting laid off, I was very fortunate in that I was picked up by Occidental Petroleum. And I went to work once again on their IT side, and I was working on the applications for their trading desk, whether that was natural gas liquids or that was energy. That was when the market in Texas, ERCOT, was deregulating, and they needed a shadow settlement system to be programmed in order to create their own retail electric provider and to shadow settle how the market was working and the pricing, and then also to take the cost of electricity, which is the number one feedstock cost of enhanced oil recovery, and disseminate that down to the oil wells in the field, because every oil well or every field has different interest owners. And so therefore, you have to get those costs down to those customers. So programmed a shadow settlement system, and that's how I came to learn electricity, is how does the system work? What are the losses on the distribution system versus the transmission system versus how do prices get set and what's unaccounted for energy? All of those kinds of things that most people don't even think about. That was how I learned them, was from programming. I had the opportunity to move to the business side, and I ran that retail electric provider for a number of years, and then expanded into intervening in utility rate cases. Because electricity is such a huge cost for oil and gas providers, as well as chlorine producers, which Oxy is the number two chlorine producer in the world, you really paid attention to that price of electricity. So I was working on everything from, optimizing when we were running pump jacks around prices in the electricity markets, to looking at chlorine production and actually participating in ancillary service programs with chlorine production. So using that rectifier controller to ramp up and down the amount of electricity. So all kinds of things. But as I was intervening in utility rate cases, utilities got to know me. And Oxy happened to be the single largest customer of Xcel Energy, a large investor-owned utility in the central U.S. that serves 8 states. And so about 15 years ago, Xcel called up and said, hey, instead of taking apart our rate cases, how would you like to put them together? So I went from this largely operations side of the business. So I went from IT to operations, you know, from building substations and optimizing energy costs to running a regulatory team. And so talk about a difference of moving from, you know, taking apart and looking at how does pricing get set for utilities and then the industrial customer impact of that to actually running that. And that's where really my perspective on my career changed. And I went from having a job that provided for my family to a purpose that provides for community. And that's because when you think about utilities, as much as we like to talk about how much it's like, oh my goodness, they're doing another rate increase or things are going on, quite frankly, we all are incredibly dependent on them. Without electricity, our lives would not function how they function. And so what my philosophy became is if I did a really good job of my job inside of that utility, I would be meeting the needs of my customers and the investors that we have at the same time. And because it's such a life impactful, it's such a life essential for customers, that is where I went for purpose. I fully expected I was going to retire from the utility sector. Then I got this phone call in October of 2024 that said, hey, we have something we'd like you to consider. And that was from Breakthrough Energy. And I had, at that time, I was chief planning officer at Xcel Energy, where I was responsible for the planning associated with capital investments for transmission, distribution, generation, and pipeline infrastructure for the gas LDC. And they said, hey, we need you to look at this stuff for the world. And when you're in a purpose-driven focus, we have a problem, just like you outlined in your opening. We have to focus more on how are we building these plans for the future. We've had 30 to 40 years of largely no load growth. That's not just in the US, that's around the world. And we've had planning tools that really have been around maintain and replace. So just keep replacing as something aged out, or if you needed to expand something, go and expand it, but do it the same way you've always done it. We have a very different world we're moving into now. And so the breakthrough opportunity in joining Bill Gates's team is such an honor, because now I get to look at this not only for 8 states in the US, which don't get me wrong, is incredibly important for the 20 million lives in that area, but for the world now and figuring out what do we need to do to figure out this problem for the future of the energy system, at the same time as figuring how do we leverage what we have today to keep moving forward.
And I'm so grateful for this explanation, because I really do think that you might be one of the only people in the world who is uniquely positioned with a background in IT and coding, plus rate cases, regulation, planning. All of this is what is required of you in the role that you're in now. So now let's talk about your work at Breakthrough. So the grid modeling team builds advanced tools to help energy planners design and operate electric grids that can support a fully decarbonized future. Now, within that, what's the focus these days? It's sort of a tall order of a mandate. So do you mind sharing a little bit more about some of the tools, the data sets, the outcomes that are really top of mind for you and for your team?
No, absolutely. And, you know, you are correct. It is a huge undertaking, but that is why we have the name Breakthrough. And that is what, you know, Bill has been focused on is we take on the big, you know, audacious type things that are not easy. And that's why it's so incredible to work amongst all of these scientists and engineers and experts inside of Breakthrough to try and tackle this. So we have a very foundational philosophy on how planning needs to move forward. And this is something that I ran into as well as leading the teams through integrated resource plans or electric infrastructure additions at the utility. And that is we need to reduce the amount of time that it takes to get to a plan in order to be able to make the investments to meet the demands that we have of the future. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Much of that comes back to human interaction and trust of what it is that are in the models and in the planning pieces. So what we are doing is fundamentally our philosophy is that we need open source tools, which is a very specific category of ways to integrate and ways to download infrastructure planning tools in order to be able to reduce the amount of friction that is in the process in order to increase the efficiency of which we can get to infrastructure planning outcomes. What that means is that, yes, we do have commercial tools out there, and they are great tools. There's a lot of benefits from them. I use them very extensively inside of Xcel, and many utilities use them around the world. But the problem is when you go into the regulatory process, many people can't afford those same tools. And so what they do is they assume that you've done something. You've leaned on the scale a little bit to get an outcome that you were looking for versus being able to validate the actuals of what is needed for the system. We have so much investment that is necessary in order to overcome the aging infrastructure, but also to meet the growth needs we are now facing. We have to get trust into this process. So when you ask about specific areas, one of the detailed ones that I think causes significant conflict is the data. Do you have access to the data? My data is better than your data. I don't agree with your data. That data is not validated. I had to go get it on the open source environment versus I could get the validated data that you have. So this difference of, you know, availability and accessibility to data is a huge piece of the puzzle. Because if you assume, let's say, a wind or a solar farm has much higher production capabilities than what it actually does, it gets selected more. But then the problem is that the operator has an unreliable system or a less reliable system. And those are the balances you have to come into alignment in order to move forward faster. So that's just one of the areas where we need. But fundamentally, we believe that this needs to be open sourced as much as possible. And that helps with accessibility. So that global piece, there's a lot of countries that cannot afford the commercial tools. So we have to give them something so that they can do a better job of getting to outcomes for their communities that match what we have in the global north or in the developed countries.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, these data discrepancies, I think, are a microcosm of the much larger existential kind of question that we have about the global power systems that we all rely on, to your earlier point, that every community everywhere relies on. So, you know, on this show, we often speak a lot with the sort of U.S. first perspective, but this is a global problem, as you're talking about. The global approach that you're taking at Breakthrough Energy is significant. What are, you know, the international implications of some of these challenges when it comes to not being able to afford commercial tools, when it comes to these, you know, data discrepancies or asymmetric data access, particularly when we're talking about low and middle income countries? Can you just kind of illustrate the realities that some of these countries are facing and how they might differ from the United States, but also how they might impact what we're dealing with in the United States?
Absolutely. And so when we think about energy, we want, just like you mentioned, you want clean, you want affordable, and you want accessible and reliable. So that has to be the foundation of what it is that we are looking at. When you think about the new technologies, newer, I should say, technologies that are coming out, whether that's wind, solar, more geothermal capabilities, and you think about these developing countries, they're more complex. Those technologies are more complex. They don't come with assurances on you turn the valve and this is what you're going to get, or you shovel a pile of coal and this is what you're going to get. They come with variables that are not as predictable. So the wind doesn't blow consistently all the time. And heavens, we all like to point to our weather forecasts and sit there and say, well, they did a good job or they did a terrible job, right? They have, you know, less than 60% accuracy, and that's okay. Less than 60% accuracy in the utility environment is really hard. And so you have to find a way of making it easier, lowering that barrier of entry to make the selections for cleaner energy for the different options that are out there, particularly as these tools and as these resources become cost effective with the other resources that are the options. So to get a country that is developing to choose something other than a natural gas plant or a coal plant, because that is easier for them, you have to give them the tools to be able to look at it, to evaluate it, to look at what are the trade-offs that I'm having, even between land utilization and water utilization versus the energy choices. So those are pieces of the puzzle that we have to put tools in their hands to be able to make those more difficult situation decisions for operations, but then to lower the barrier of entry so that they're doing things that are better for the community that they are implementing them for, and so that they're meeting the needs. And we're looking at this on a global basis to make the world a better place for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think it wasn't that long ago that we had this massive blackout in the Iberian Peninsula that became a huge story in the United States, because this is one of those stories that I think really illustrates the idea that there's sort of a domino effect. It's the borders are borders that exist in a certain way, yes, but we all rely on each other. We rely on supply chains that are largely based in other countries. You know, it's not just insular in the United States for U.S. listeners. This is a global problem. This is a global economy that we are living in, you know, 2026. So with all of this in mind, you know, I want to talk now about how this kind of comes to fruition. You know, I mentioned at the top that I really want to focus on solutions here. So I think modeling, smart modeling, what we're talking about here, can be a really big part of that solution. So I'd love if you can kind of just walk me through, you know, some of the the criticality of modeling on this side of the equation, why we should be talking about this on par with the physical build out that we spend so much time and spill so much ink thinking about and talking about when we're thinking infrastructure. You know, why does modeling matter just as much, maybe more? Tell me a little bit about how you're viewing that.
So one of the conversations I love having with people is around the laws of physics. The laws of physics are not governed by laws that individuals as humans we pass. The laws of physics are inherent to the environment that we have been gifted as this planet and the universe that we exist in. And so the beauty of the laws of physics is that it's consistent around the world. So when we talk about global benefit or global impact, when we make advances on the modeling side, whether it's in the US, it's in the EU, it's in India, wherever you may be, it helps everyone because the laws of physics are consistent. So first off, kind of as a basis, is those are the rules that we have to operate by. And this is why modeling is so important, because the laws of physics can inherently be put into a program. And you can look at the capabilities associated with technologies, and then you layer in the weather, and you layer in the geography, and you layer in the the mix of industry in a certain area. Because if you have, like, say, a steel electric arc furnace in a jurisdiction for industry or a lot of data centers, that's a very different system than if you have a highly weather-dependent, manufacturing facility that is only operating during daytime hours, those kinds of things. So you have to build these different systems, but modeling is integral in being able to identify what it is you need. I'll give you an example. So one of the questions inside of Xcel Energy that we asked was, is the distribution system that we are building today, if we were to continue building it out all the way through 2050, would it be what customers need in 2050? So let's talk a little bit about that. Today, we have a low percentage of adoption relatively of electric vehicles as compared to what we could see in 2050. If that eventuality of adoption of electric vehicles is what was forecasted, then that's going to change dramatically how people are using energy in their own home, how much of that energy, what time of day they're using that energy. So then the question has to become, well, what about the size of the wire? What if all the homes are doing that? So if we just put in the same thing again as what we've been putting in the past, is that sufficient? I just mentioned electric transportation, but there's also home heating. If people move off of gas to electric, say, and adopt the heat pumps for their homes, that's going to change the cycle for how people heat their homes and the energy curve that we look at. So all of these things are adding up to the customers changing the way they're using energy. Is our design basis, which is the reference we use as engineers to look at how you build a distribution system, is it sufficient for the future? This is where modeling comes in. Because first off, you got to pull out your crystal ball. And number one, any modeler, any good modeler would tell you is I will be wrong. I will not be exactly right when I give you this model and this prediction for the future. The question is how good can you get? How close can you get? And what are those parameters that you have to move around what it is that you pick in order to adopt and adjust for different situations? So you're looking for flexibility as well. You're not looking for one precise answer that's perfect, because you're using a crystal ball. And people, you don't call the utility when you say, hey, I'm going to turn my lights on this morning. You just do it. And so that is something that we have to build into the process. Modeling is core to that. What kind of system are we building? What are we choosing? What we found inside of Xcel is when we did that distribution infrastructure look of predicting in that crystal ball what that future customer would look like compared to the design basis we were building for, there was a gap. And if we don't fix that gap, what ends up happening is you continue building into the future on your existing design basis. Well, you get to a point where you go, uh-oh, we have a problem. And the problem is then you have to replace what you already put in that's not at end of life. And that increases costs for customers. And that's not what any utility wants. That's not what any system wants. So that's where it comes back to, is the modeling is critical for us to continuously look at not just what do we need today, but what is this system of the future going to look like? Because when we make grid infrastructure investments, they're not five-year investments, unless you're looking only at the software. And the software is not what we're really talking about here. We're talking about the wires, the transformers, the meters, all of those kinds of pieces of the puzzle. Those are 30, 40, 50, 60-year investments. And they depreciate over that time frame, which is an incredibly important piece of the puzzle, but most people just shuffle aside because it's really boring. But it really is what comes back to establishing what your rates are from a utility and what you have to pay. We can't afford to have to build this stuff twice because we're not picking the right stuff now. That's my main point. And that's why modeling has to come in to look at those futures, to establish what infrastructure we need. And it also comes back to new technologies on how are we going to solve the problems that we've seen coming in the future.
It brings up an interesting question for me that I'm curious if this kind of comes up in conversations that you're having on your team when we're talking about modeling to build for that better future, to the point that some of this infrastructure is 50, a lot of it is 50 plus years old. It has depreciated over the last several decades. How much of modeling is trying to kind of balance righting the wrongs that maybe we missed in the past 50, 60 years ago with ensuring that we don't make those mistakes again in the future? Is there any sort of, you know, retroactive element of modeling of the work that you're doing?
Well, I will tell you, just from looking at, so if you're looking at like clean energy transition, one of the metrics at Excel for the executives was achieving a certain reduction of carbon from 2005 levels. And so when we had to use that crystal ball, right, to look at what's the prediction. And then when it actually happened, everybody wanted to know what was the delta, right? Why did it not come out where it was? So there are always ways that you can look back at, you know, what happened, what was different from the forecast versus the reality, and everything. It goes everything from price of natural gas to, you know, availability of supply chain materials. So maybe a project didn't come on in time that you wanted. But to the question that you are asking specifically, when you look at the grid system, you are continuously seeing improvement in whether it's operations of transformers, capacity and throughput on wire. And so you can't really sit there and say, we made a mistake in the past. You made decisions based off of what was available at that time, right? And right. Hindsight's always 20/20, right? And so it's really easy to throw rocks at, well, why didn't you do this 30 years ago? Well, the facts weren't there 30 years ago for us to even choose this. Or maybe it was a new technology at that point in time. It's like, no, we're going to pilot this first before we put it across the system, because what if it doesn't work? And so there's all these balances of risk and reward, because this goes back to electricity as a fundamental life essential. The utility cannot inject undue risk into that process to interrupt that, because then people's lives are impacted, interrupted, or even cause severe outcomes. So you have to really be conscious about the decisions you're making, which goes back to modeling again. What's the potential? What's the probability? What risk are you putting into the system? How much variability can you have around things? And this is a hard conversation. If you've had conversations around data centers on your podcast, I'm sure you've talked about the five nines. They want 99.999% assurance that they're going to have electricity. Well, for the typical grid, you get three nines and then you get an eight. And that is what people want to actually pay for, because to get that fourth nine or that fifth nine, you have to overbuild infrastructure or do more to invest in the infrastructure. And that increases the cost. So there's a balance across all of this that we have to strike in what it is that we are deciding to build.
Yeah, absolutely. And a good lesson for many of the conversations that we have on the show, that hindsight is 20/20. We're all doing the best with the information that we have right now, which I think is a good segue to talk to about some of the, you know, the challenges and potential shortcomings when we're looking at modeling the world today, what the energy world can look like tomorrow. The thing that I think comes to mind for me first is this idea that we don't know what the next breakthrough technology is, right? We don't necessarily know if, you know, we say fusion is always 30 years away. What if it's 2 years away and we're just not sure? So I'm curious to hear how you plan for that, how you, you know, allot for the possibility that something really crazy could happen, that this, you know, a black swan event could happen, but also something really innovative could happen in the next couple of years when we're planning for timelines that are much longer than that.
Yeah, I really do think this is a conundrum that many regulators face, that many decision makers face, because it doesn't take just, you know, a couple of weeks to build a wind farm or a solar farm or a gas plant or a nuclear facility, right? And so there's the mix of needing those in the equation and be continuously developing those and spending dollars, like millions and billions of dollars on developing those at the same time as crossing your fingers that this new technology is coming in. This is one of the reasons I love being inside of Breakthrough, because we are investing on the venture capital side of the organization in fusion and in fission and in geothermal and in all of these other components in order to be able to look at, okay, this world, we need to continue investing in the innovation, but at the same time, we have to be grounded in the practical reality of deliverability. So one of the things that as a modeling team, we would talk about is we could put together the most beautiful model right? That has wonderful, wonderful outcomes. But unless it's implementable, it's not so pretty. So how do we make sure that supply chain is taken into account? Innovation is taken into account. And one of the gaps on the innovation side that my teams inside of Excel faced is if you don't have the data, going back to our earlier conversation, if you don't have the data to represent it appropriately in the model, it's like that innovation doesn't exist because the model can't select it. It can't deploy it. It can't pick it as an alternative to something else. So one of the things we're focused on the Grids team inside of Breakthrough is figuring out how do we create an environment, a platform, a community where those that are working on these innovations can get the right data assembled so that those people that are inside of the utilities or in other areas where modeling is taking place can look at the potential for these technologies to solve the problems we are still facing. If the goal is net zero carbon on the system, we don't have all the technologies we need to get there. We don't have everything that's going to make it affordable. We still need innovation and technologies to come to the table. But unless we are exposing the problems we still face, which are different around the world, because some areas have high wind, great solar, others have bad wind, bad solar. You know, some have great hydro opportunities, you know, you name it. But we have to expose these problems so that the innovators that are out there in universities, private companies, laboratories can tackle those problems. That's one of the reasons I really love working on this modeling side, because to me, it is foundational to establishing what is possible versus what is still needed. And then you come smack dab running face first into the realities of supply chain construction. And supply chain isn't just the infrastructure. It's not just the steel you need, not the turbine, not the transformer. It's also the people. The human capital that is necessary to achieve these outcomes, whether it's on the modeling teams, which quite frankly have shrunk over the years because we haven't needed as much effort there, to the people on the ground actually building something. We have to be very realistic that this is something that we are all facing constraints on, and they're not just in the US. It is a global competitive market right now for solving this problem. And so those are the pieces of the puzzle that I would encourage people to continuously think about, have a little grace for. But it goes back to that planning piece again. Yes, we may have to extend lives on existing infrastructure longer than we're comfortable for. Yes, we need to be looking at new technologies and we need to be finding a better pathway to pilot them and to reduce the risk of them not working or them being incredibly successful. We have to put protections around that in order to be able to move forward. I really hope the advancements in fusion, fission, and geothermal are right around the corner, but I can't bank on it as somebody, as you know, sitting in a utility formerly and an operator, that that's going to be there to serve my customers. I still have to make decisions that have investment in order to make sure that those electrons are there to serve the customers in the way that they're looking for them.
Planning for multiple futures, we have an ideal, certainly, but everybody knows that that does not always come to fruition. Now, you know, Alice, I think this brings up an interesting point that I would love to hear your thoughts on. You know, we mentioned before you were talking about the importance of the work that you're doing being open source, that this data is available to people all over the world of all different backgrounds, all different careers. That, I think, is an important element of this conversation. And I'm curious how that might play into the question of equitable access to these technologies, to these incredible technologies that are coming to the forefront that might change everything in a handful of years or maybe in 30 years even. You know, the technology, the data that we have, it has to be deployable, as you have mentioned. So how does the open source element of the work that you're doing help to ensure, if at all, that there is equitable access? Can you talk to me a little bit about what that looks like, especially when we're talking about, you know, technology breakthroughs in the United States versus technology breakthroughs being deployed in, you know, the global South and these lower and middle income countries? What does that look like?
So before I dive in directly to that, one of the things I'm going to go back to is what you mentioned earlier on about like the Iberian Peninsula outage. It's fascinating to me, especially as I stepped into this role in Breakthrough, because I was exclusively concentrating on the US-based market and not really looking at what was happening outside of the walls of the US extensively. I had made one international trip to kind of do an exchange back in 2017, but nothing really intensely. We can learn a lot from each other. So the Iberian outage is similar to some of the problems that ERCOT was experiencing 5 to 7 years ago with the wind that was built in West Texas. And so those kinds of things, you know, is somehow we have to have better conversations globally in order to share information, data, and impacts, in order to be able to learn from each other and avoid making the same mistakes again and again versus, you know, avoiding those mistakes because somebody else already experienced it. So when you talk about the global impact of modeling and looking at what it is we're doing here and how are we going to help, particularly the global South, there's something that we talk about as head of breakthrough energy called the green premium. We all know when wind came out and was growing initially, it cost a lot more than it does today. Same thing for solar, same thing for battery storage. This is the life cycle of new technology that costs more when the production is less in the supply and demand curve. Go back to economics. This is how it works. The global South can't afford to pay that green premium. We can't push that on them. So as we're developing technology and adopting in the North, we have to make sure that the benefits of bringing that cost curve down get to go to the people in the global South as they're developing these systems. And this is where the open environment comes into play. We have to be able to learn from each other. We have to be able to improve the technology we're using for modeling. We have to make accessible the information and intel that those models need for these new technologies in order to make them adoptable. So that's why we advocate very strongly for the open environment. It's for that transparency. It's for the reduction of human conflict. It's also for making it easier for modelers to do what they need to do. The thing in modeling that takes the majority of the time is actually developing and making sure that the data that you have is clean and it's in a format that you need to run your model. What we're envisioning is an environment where we have a global data store that already has it formatted in a way that can go into the models. And then a translator that lets you move it between the different models that you want to use. So say you want to use an open source model such as PipeSet. You can take it from the data store and put it in the format you need for PipeSet. So that translator takes care of that. If you want to use Plexos, which is a commercial tool, great. Pull the data from the data store. It will translate into what you need as your input for Plexos. So we're dramatically reducing the amount of time that it takes for data refinement. That also helps the Global South. The pieces of the puzzle, there's two big buckets of data. One bucket of data is common information that everybody uses that is generally the same. So think of that as like, you have a Siemens CT that is this frame that was made in this year. It has a certain heat curve that goes with it. That is the same for everyone. That kind of bucket of data should be universal and global, validated by the people who are closest to it and made available. The other bucket of data is specific grid information. And this gets into a whole conversation too on security, accessibility, and everything else. So one of the things we're working on is what needs to happen with specific data to be aggregated so that those people who do not have clearance can still run models to get validation and verification, but they don't have enough data and information to become a threat vector. So those are the scientific questions we're asking. There's all kinds of great people in computer science fields and universities and laboratories that are helping us look at this. How much do we have to aggregate? How do we make sure that it doesn't become a threat vector? How do we give a centralized global environment so that we can picture this and we can lower the barrier of entry and increase people's probability of designing systems that are successful for their communities?
Yeah, I think the security one, it feels like we would be opening an entirely other can of worms. But I'll just briefly ask you, is this a concern for the utility leaders you're you know, interfacing with? One of the big buzzwords that we hear time and again on this show is cybersecurity, security threats, et cetera, et cetera. How do you ensure it? I mean, is there a way that we can share as much as possible without opening ourselves up to threats?
I really do think there is. And I think we have some great examples outside of the U.S. where there's dramatic progress being made. If people are interested, you should go research what NISO is doing. They're in the U.K. in order to make real-time access available under lock and key. So people have to validate, certify, all of those kinds of things to have real-time access to data there in order to share it between DSOs, TSOs, and other entities in order to make a more efficient market. There are some examples out there of people making dramatic progress in these spaces in order to effectuate outcomes that they're looking for, lower costs for customers, increase the amount of clean energy that can be used, reduce the amount of ancillary services that have to be on the system in order to have a reliable system to be operated going forward. There's so much that is happening in this space right now. It's really exciting. And that's why we're asking the question. We are not making the assumption that you can get there. We have faith that we are going to find a pathway, but we're asking the detailed questions of how do you set this up? But there are so many other questions too. How do we make sure that we're not taking too much data storage up? How do you make sure that you can have efficient access? How do you make sure you have the right clearances? How do you reduce the risk associated with something going sideways? And cybersecurity is a whole big piece of the puzzle. So, but access to really smart people and being able to ask the question, to test it, to figure out what the pathway is, that is what we are focused on, because we think this makes a material difference in planning around the world and achieving outcomes more efficiently and cost effectively.
You know, I think a lot of this conversation so far has really focused on some of these particularly actionable insights for utility decision makers, which is, you know, a lot of people who are listening to this. To add on to that, I'm curious about, you know, any advice you have for taking action, for next best steps, for how to go from idea to model to reality, maybe more for like the innovators or the startup founders or that part of our audience. You know, what's your advice to them in terms of best path forward to make change happen fast and cheap?
I think it's number one, participate, speak up. Any innovator out there has to look at, you know, if they're developing some technology for the electric grid, they have to look at, okay, how is this going to improve the situation? Otherwise, they're not going to sell their product, right? I mean, if there's not a place for it to be adopted. So they should be engaging with the modelers, with the laboratories that are looking at these things in order to figure it out. The other one I would say is this a sector that we haven't gotten involved in at Breakthrough, but I know I had a passion for inside of Xcel and was pressing people to develop on, is really around the distribution system. We need software that gives better algorithms to put in place to dispatch the flexibility that we're all saying is necessary. Europe has been talking about this for a long time. India is focusing on it very specifically right now. We haven't done as good of a job of developing the software that's necessary for these distribution organizations to ensure that they're not going to have failures on their feeders. And how does that connect all the way back into the energy management system, the EMS, that is dispatching the generation and the transmission components? There's so much opportunity here for innovators. But if you're listening to this call and you have a technology that you think is the next best thing, you need to find someone that understands how the modeling works. And you need to figure out how to get your technology into the modeling processes to go, does it really help? And if it does really help, then get in the process like with an EPRI or somebody else to test it in the laboratory so that it can go to the utilities and go, look, it's UL certified. It's been through the laboratory testing for EPRI. It's ready to go. And then for the utilities that are out there, you've got to lower the barrier of entry to test these things out. And it can't be that you have, yeah, it's been tested by 12 utilities, but no, it has to be tested by mine too. At some level, it has to be like, this works. And we need to move a little bit faster on the adoption and figuring out how it gets in there. And I do think that it also helps if we get it in the planning tools, you can see what the benefit's going to be or not for your own system. So invest in your planners, invest in your modelers, find more resources. For those of you that are in university and studying, go out and figure out the analytics. The modeling component is going to be huge. Please, you know, go and find those opportunities and learn what it means, because it starts here. I used to advocate that the regulatory team inside of the utilities where you learned everything, because you always had to go back to your regulator to tell them everything that you were doing, from the finances to the operations to the components. And I still advocate for that. If you want to learn how a utility works, go join the regulatory team. If you want to know what a future utility is going to look like, you need to be in planning and modeling. And that is where there's an opportunity that I think is incredible in order to be able to design what the future is going to look like to serve all of these people that rely on this resource as a life essential.
Mic drop, 100%. I feel like I am Uncle Sam wants you to work in energy. Like the more time I spend in this industry, the more I feel so compelled to share with smart young people that this is a cool, interesting, innovative space to be in. So I appreciate the insight that you're sharing in terms of that as well, Alice. So as we finish up today, you know, we've talked a lot about modeling for the future, what the future might look like, how to ensure equitable access, how to ensure that we are avoiding data discrepancies to the extent that we can in the effort to build this better grid of the future, this better global power reality of the future. So what does that reality look like to you? You know, what does success ultimately look like to you? If all of this goes to plan, what is your ideal global grid of the future in, you know, a few words?
Yeah, for me, it is the net zero carbon. I think we have to be realistic in that perfect zero carbon is really too expensive. I hope new technology comes out and makes me wrong. Prove me wrong, please. But at the very least, net zero, moving that direction. I believe it's a future where we are more interconnected than what we've ever been, but it is easy for consumers to do that. I have aging parents, just like many people out there. They're not going to be watching their cell phone all the time in order to go, do I want to change my thermostat or not? No, we have to make it easy for people to interact with, but we absolutely need flexibility. I challenged my team to think about a world where there's 20% flexibility around the clock of the demand on the system. That's large customers, that's small customers, that's charging electric vehicles, because we need that to meet the future and bring the cost of that future down. And so for me, the future involves nuclear, it involves geothermal, it involves flexible systems, it involves software that is going to enable things, and it involves a customer base that is more informed and educated about energy and their environments than they've ever been before. I would say over the past 30-ish years, maybe skip the past 10 and go to the 30 years before that, we have done an inadequate job of expressing to people how, when they use energy, impacts the cost of that energy. And we are getting a lot better at it, but we also have to have a consumer mind shift on being on board with it. Go to the countries where they have high adoption of electric vehicles or high adoption of renewables. Everybody is aligned and on board. Go read about Uruguay and what they've done in order to align things. They had politics aligned with people, with communities, and everybody leaning into this future. How do we get the human element aligned is one of the other pieces of the puzzle that I think is essential. And that's going to take a lot of work, a lot of talking, and a lot of listening, quite frankly, as well.
Maybe more people listening to Power Perspectives, where they can hear conversations just like this one. Alice, this has been just such an incredible and impactful conversation. I feel like we covered so much. As we finish up, I would love to transition into our quick lightning round, rapid fire section to close us out here. So if you don't mind answering these questions in just a couple words, we'll have some fun before I let you go.
Sounds great.
So first up, what do you think is the biggest blind spot for utilities today in a handful of words?
God, that's a tricky question. I think the biggest blind spot for utilities today is the impacts that the short-term decisions that they are making that are driven to satisfy political or financial outcomes and what adverse impacts they're going to have over the long term.
All right. Got to think for the long term. Mm-hmm. Okay. Next one. What is a moonshot kind of technology that you see kind of coming down the pipeline right now that makes you feel really excited or optimistic?
I am really excited about what geothermal can do, but I'm also incredibly excited about the new advanced nuclear opportunities. We have a lot to get through as far as, you know, provision of the fuel that goes in them, but I really do think they have a huge future capability for us.
All right. I dig it. Now, final question for you. Do you have any hot takes about the next, you know, decade, half decade of energy that maybe would surprise our listeners? Anything you want to get off your chest while you're here on Power Perspectives?
So now we're moving to therapy.
Yes.
I'm going to give you two. I'm going to take a little bit of latitude here. On the downside, your electricity prices are not going down. And maybe that's not a surprise to everyone, but I encourage you to have a conversation at some time on Power Perspectives about depreciation and how that goes into utility rate making, because 55 years age, largely depreciated, cheap system. We have to replace most of that infrastructure, which means you go back to the top of the depreciation curve, really expensive. It's new, but it's expensive. So your rates are not going down. I'm sorry. Yes, there are things to mitigate it, but they're not going down. On the positive side, oh my gosh. I mean, the innovation that is out there, if you were to take 10 minutes, go look at TS Conductor, go look at Rondo, go look at, you know, all the things that are happening out there, TerraPower, all of these other ones. The innovators out there are incredible. So you should be excited about what this future is like. And go and look at these companies and what they are working on. It is amazing. And the future is only going to be better than what we are seeing today.
I love it. What a way to end this conversation. It's all getting better. It's a tough problem to solve, but we have clearly, as you have shown us today, Alice, some of the brightest minds trying to figure it out. So thank you so much for taking the time to join me. This has been such a wonderful conversation. I'm really, really grateful for you joining us here on Power Perspectives today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Awesome. And thank you to all of our listeners for once again tuning in. I'm Kinsey Grant-Baker, and I will see you next time.